Cubish first, and then see if I can circle back to this. I'm much more familiar with the Cubish. I've only seen as much as you all have. But so my feeling about the Cubish work, just, people probably know some of this work, but Christina Cubish has done a series of these pieces, including some in New York. Is that part of your show, The Kitchen? She's designed these headphones. Okay, there's a picture of one of the sets of headphones. And generally the way it works is you go to the gallery and you get a set of these headphones, and then she sometimes provides a map, and you go out into the city where, you know, where the gallery is, and she suggests, although doesn't demand, that you go to certain places where you're likely to pick up electromagnetic fields in these headphones, which are, you know, then transposed into the range of human hearing. So the idea is, as these people are doing, you can go up to ATMs or to shop windows or to public transportation systems and pick up the sounds of the electromagnetic fields that kind of run the city. So, you know, there is a way to think of this work, and I think it's the way it's probably more often than not thought of, is as this kind of engagement with a sonic, so sonic domain that we don't normally have access to, and you know, to be able to hear that. Maybe there's some suggestion that it's hearing an aspect of the city that we don't normally have access to. And again, that seems to be somewhat like the Aiken piece. First of all, I don't buy it. I don't buy the argument that this is an aspect of the city to which we don't normally have access, because it's that, how do I put this? That experience of transposing the sounds of electromagnetic fields into audibility takes something that normally exists in a certain way or has a certain function within the life of the city. Those electromagnetic fields run things. They move elevators, or they run the ATM so you can get cash. The sound of them is absolute byproduct to their functionality. So what you're interacting with when you interact with the sound is not at all the, you're not going to like this word, but the meaning of that electromagnetic field.
Surely that's true of any musical instrument, though, right?
Well,
there's an object, or let's say non-traditional musical, you know, this milk crate, right? When a drummer plays the milk crate, you want to say, my God, it's a fucking milk crate. No, you're not supposed to bang on it. You're supposed to, it's a milk crate. No?
Well, but I think there's a different insinuation in terms of how those two gestures. So I think with the Cubish piece, at least the way some people read it, there's an insinuation, again, of privileged access to sensory experience, meaningful sensory experience, sorry, I'll get to you just one sec, that we don't normally have access to. So now, to try to relate this back to the question about Lussier, so there are differences in Lussier's work. Something like Music on a Long Thin Wire, let's just put that in one category, is more or less encounter with phenomena, as you described it. And to my mind, then, not as interesting within Lucia's body of work as something like Vespers, which I think was a good example. Vespers is a piece where performers use little echolocation devices, little clickers, in a space that's been darkened. And they click the clickers to try to locate themselves in the space because they can't see. So that you can hear from the echo of the clicker when you're getting close to a wall or some other surface. And so you navigate the space based on this auditory information you're getting back. So what happens is a composition is created of clicks by the four or five performers, whatever it is, and a choreography is created that's based entirely on different a different generation of instructions, if you will. And what that leads to then is a kind of social interaction among the performers and among audience members who are in the space with the performers. There's a different relationship, or a different awareness, let's say, established of space and sound and so forth that is meaningful in terms of body in space, navigation in space, you know, those sorts of things. So I think that Vespers is a much more interesting piece to my mind than Music on a Long Thin Wire. And I think, you know, for me, I can almost put all of Lucia's work into one category or the other. Those that have implications beyond the purely physical aspects of sound. How did I start that? You know, those that go beyond that and those that don't.
So I was just going to say, maybe this is another important difference, and maybe I think it's another, again, hopefully it's not just an idiosyncratic difference. some sense, I want to say, like, I'm not interested in, well, I am. No, but I just want to say, like, what I'm interested in is placing that in the broader context of, this is why for me I call it naturalism, I call it materialism. For me, it derives ultimately from Nietzsche, to some degree Deleuze. I don't want to say it derives from that, but I want to say, like, the sort of philosophical impetus resonates with those figures. I think it's hugely important to situate human beings in that broader context and not just say, if it's not meaningful for me as this particular kind of social creature in this particular kind of context, then it's uninteresting or forgettable or whatever. I'd rather say, how can I transpose myself as a human being into this broader kind of context in which I have a relationship with the entire domain of the entire world, which I am, right? And not just with those peculiar things that, you know, human beings have called culture or whatever.
So there was a question in the back, somebody was patient.
Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment, like, about the whole thing is, all the pieces that you showed so far is, like, what you're talking about is, like, what is the interesting aspect of these pieces or what they have in common? It's like, to me, the interesting aspect of all the pieces seems to be that they're happening live at the time that you're listening to it. And instead of what the sound is coming from, it's like a hole or like an ATM, a hole in the ground, like an ATM or anything like that. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with what you're hearing, really, but the fact that it's all of the pieces that you showed are things that are happening live.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you think about the difference between a field recording or listening to a CD of field recordings, like, for example, like Francisco Lopez has field recordings of nature and things like that. Just, it's similar to the Aiken thing, in a way.
Yeah.
But it's not happening live, it's edited. And people go see.
Sometimes edited, not always.
All right, so can we, if I could use that to try to circle back. So for the Christina Kubisch electrical walks, I don't dismiss them. So back to this image. I don't dismiss them for the fact that a lot of people read them the way I've described it. I find them really interesting works because what happens is, again, like Vespers, the sound aspect of it, the attempt to interact with sound, forces people into interesting social, geographical, navigational kinds of situations. So people walk around in a city with these clunky big headphones on their heads, putting their heads up against ATMs and so forth, and becoming conspicuous in ways that they wouldn't normally do. And so you wind up with this...
becomes a performance piece rather than a song.
But not simply performance, it's also social. So if, you know, I don't know if these two women know each other, but maybe, you know, you could come across someone else with headphones that you didn't know ahead of time and decide to go along together and figure out which are the interesting sweet spots for the headphones, or, you know, again, I think that conspicuousness, that you become conspicuous wearing these headphones, walking around the city, and putting your head up against stuff, also is a really interesting feature of the piece. The piece has implications beyond the auditory that I find much more interesting. And now we can circle back to the piece you,
what's with the tram vibration piece, I think it's gone. I think it's gone.
So I'm curious about this. So that piece is being released as a CD of just the audio that's been edited and mixed. Personally, I'm much more interested in the documentation than the video. And the distinction that they're making, which I find curious, and I wish they were here and I could ask them why not release it as the DVD? And why, you know, what's that sort of after the fact editing and mixing?
Yeah.
What does it add to the final result that I should like any better than watching that video? What did you find?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't present it because I find it the most interesting piece. I presented it because I think it's a kind of what they're interested in. Sunoda, in particular, is interested in, you know, thinking of the world as a potentially sort of infinite set of vibrations, right? And that these can be captured in various ways. And a lot of these are real straightforward field recordings. A lot of his stuff is. So in this case, it's, you know, they hired a tram in Osaka, right, and took it the entire route of its entire route, and, you know, did these recordings along the way. And what I think is interesting about the piece, I'd have to spend more time with it to really kind of suss out what's rich about it. But what's interesting about it is that it's a collection of intriguing sounds that wouldn't be audible to the ordinary, you know, tramp. It elicits and amplifies a whole set of vibrations, whether they be electromagnetic stuff like the Kubisch stuff, or just various rumblings of metal, of, you know, metal
rich and interesting project. I wanted to, a couple of questions. I want to come back to and ask Seth maybe if he can say more about, I think, this important concept of a non-cochlear sonic art, which you'll say more about. We can come back to that after this. Yeah, Alan?
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of jump in there and kind of ask you guys if you think that part of the appeal of this is, because in all the pieces we've, not every single one, but in a lot of pieces you guys have talked about, it's almost a kind of surveillance, right? You know, you're trying to see, like, what's going on.
Totally. So it only went on, you know, sometimes, right? Yeah, go ahead.
So, I mean, is this, I mean, do you think that this maybe is part of the appeal of, like, people's kind of curiosity about that sort of thing, rather than what the actual sound is? It's more just knowing what's going on, you know?
I think it's both.
Go back.
I think it's both. Yeah, I mean, I think the surveillance aspect is definitely there. And, yeah, so it's whatever the auditory version of voyeurism is, yeah. Yeah, there's a kind of, auditory fascination with what's sort of behind the scenes, whatever. I mean, the thing is, Seth doesn't actually think that the stuff is behind the scenes. He thinks it's manufactured, but there's something. In back, wait. Yeah.
Well, I have a couple sort of multi-part questions for you. I mean, the Christina Kubitsch piece, too, she also composes short pieces based on, you know, her particular walks around that. So sort of, you know, it's not simply about, you know, a random encounter with electromagnetic.
Can you speak up? I'm having
trouble hearing. It's not only sort of simply about this, like, random encounter with electromagnetic waves and the phenomenon of walking, but engaging with those waves.
So just to repeat this, so Christina Kubitsch, she takes this as raw material for compositions as well, yeah, which she makes into compositions, which are layered and edited, yeah.
So, and then, I guess, you say you find things more interesting outside of the actual engagement with the electromagnetic waves, like people becoming conspicuous, leaning up against an ATM. That can really happen without the object. And in a lot of ways, I feel like this conversation can happen without the sonic pavilion, right? And it seems, you know, you both sort of discredit the notion of the translation of the material doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter how the microphone, how the sonification inside the earth is being translated.
Is that
translated
to me? And I don't care.
Both of you, okay. I think, ignore this. And I mean, I think that's really, you know, what's at stake with the work of art. And in a lot of ways, there's nothing at stake with the work of art and the presentation that you guys are, you know, bringing forth. What's at stake for you is sort of a philosophical, conceptual issue, and it's really sort of, you know, doesn't, the art itself doesn't matter.
I totally don't think that's true. I mean, so, yeah, we're having a theoretical discussion about sound, playing some sounds, saying a lot of words, but those sounds prompt sets of thoughts and distinctions and disagreements, and it seems that the stuff is completely important. I think Seth and I maybe disagree a little bit about this. I think Seth often finds the stuff as much more interesting as a prompt for other things, and that maybe is a good lead into talking about the non-cochlear sonic art stuff. I don't know.
Thank you, Christoph.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so I'm not sure when you say, you know, not finding the art itself interesting, what that would mean. So is that formalism? Is it the, you know, the formal aspects of the work and its sort of internal construction that would be the interesting part, or?
I don't know, interest is a good question. I guess what I would find sort of like interesting in a work of art is, you know, like how it can be sort of like mobilized or used or, you know, done, you know, worked with. I don't necessarily a formal concern. I don't know if that's really sort of relevant.
But what did you say it mobilizes, or what?
Something.
Something. Yeah, well, that's what I was trying.
conversations at Issue Project Room, for example.
Yeah.
But I also think there's actually sort of, I mean, you know, there's the idea of a mobilization and a free flow, and then there's actual physical objects that, you know, you can sort of like map out, you know, affects there, but there is something there. And that, you know, is, you know, the discussion of that has to be very sort of specific and cannot be like abstracted in a certain way. Like there are sort of conditions in place with the Sonic Pavilion. That there is a translation mechanism between the microphone and the human ear, and an analyzation of what that process is has matters in the discussion of the piece.
Oh, I agree completely. Yeah. So if I haven't made that clear, then I'm sorry. So the non-colloquial idea. So it's pretty simple, really. You know, Duchamp talked about a non-retinal visual art. So with the ready-mades, he's talking about an art that exists visually, that, you know, has a visual manifestation, but where the primary concern or the primary sort of action of the work, if you will, isn't the action that happens through the retina, through the eye, but it's, you know, that's merely a trigger for conceptual concerns, right? So that's Duchamp's idea about a non-retinal visual art. So I'm just stealing the idea, just stealing the phrase, actually, and supplanting the retina, you know, the part of the eye, with the cochlea, the part of the ear, and saying, you know, why, the question that my book asks is, why didn't the sonic arts, and I try to be broad with that word, I don't say sound art and I don't say music, because I'm trying to talk a little bit about both, but why didn't the sonic arts experience a similar turn, a sort of Duchampian or post-Duchampian turn? So when, you know, Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns discovered Duchamp in the late 50s, and then the conceptual artists got on board and, you know, and everything was off to the races, why didn't the sonic arts do something similar? My argument in the book is that to some extent they did, but it's been kind of overlooked or it's been mistheorized in a way. So I look at certain artists from that period, from sort of, you know, the middle part of the 20th century, and say that in fact they were doing conceptual work, but it just hasn't been thought about that way. So Luc Ferrari, the sort of second generation music concrete composer, strikes me as someone who's working conceptually in a way that Pierre Schaeffer, the first music concrete founder, wasn't working in a similarly conceptual fashion. And then, you know, I try to bring the argument up to the present. Marina, who's here, talked about her work as having certain conceptual aspects, not to. And the argument about a non-cochlear sonic art is not that it doesn't have sound. Marina's work clearly does, but it's about the sound engaging, activating other concerns in the process of the manufacturing or the capturing or the curating or whatever it is of the sound. So, in a nutshell, that's that argument. Yeah, do you want to say something about that?
I want to stick with this particular. We can come back to that, but I want to stick with this particular issue. I don't know. Do you want to give us an example of something that you think is kind of works along these lines?
Let me see which of my examples might fit in. I wasn't really thinking of sort of trying to illustrate this point.
If you'd rather. Let me just. Well, I was just going to say quickly that one of the and this is maybe a bit of a crass critique of stuff, or maybe it's not a critique of stuff. But anyway, so here it goes. So you know, when we read music critics, I'd say even most music critics, but let's just say bad ones. And one of the things that so. You know, you listen to a band or whatever, you're asked to review it, you really don't have anything to say about the sound. So you talk about the scene that they're involved in, you talk about the lyrics, right, because there's actual language you can deal with. But there's very little description of or evaluation of the sonic stuff, right? I think that's a pretty sort of regular problem with sort of music criticism. Maybe disagree, but... And I worry a little bit that Seth's notion of the non-cochlear sonic art really falls into that same kind of trap. It's like, I have nothing to say about the sound. In fact, it can't be described. It can't be theorized. It can't really be talked about. Did you read the book?
I did. I learned the thing.
Anyway, but that, and as I said, it's a bit crass. So it's a bit of a an odd way around. Is to say that the idea that sound is just a trigger for other things, for social actions, for discourses about whatever, is to me, I think, kind of indicative of the inability of theoretical discourse to actually talk about sound.
No, but I very carefully, like, so one of the things I tried to do with this book, which I'll confess right off the bat, I don't think was all that successful, but the attempt was in earnest to bring music that doesn't normally get talked about in these ways into this book. So I talk about Muddy Waters, I talk about Bob Dylan and others. And I make, I think probably the longest sustained engagement with the work in this book is with Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, trying to talk about the way the sonic aspects of that work create the meaning of that work, which for me is about as meaningful as a rock or a pop song can get, partly through its history, which is not specifically the sonic aspects. But I do very carefully go through what the drums are doing, what the piano is doing, the tambourine falling out of time at certain moments, and the organization of
that's true, and it's a really rich and weird, and I mean that in a good way, reading of that overread piece.
Yeah. Because so I want to emphasize that.
No, I just mean to say that a lot of people have got a lot to say about it. Let me say that, and this is strange and interesting in a good way.
I'll take it as a
compliment. No, seriously.
So, so it's only through the way that the sound is that whatever meaning can be extracted. That wasn't a very well constructed sentence. But it's through the way that the sound is that meaning can be extracted. But it's not only through the way sound is that meaning can be extracted. It's through the whole narrative apparatus that accompanies any sound that we hear, including Aitken's Pavilion, which has a very elaborate narrative apparatus. The idea of sound in itself is nonsensical to me because we never experience sound in itself. We always hear sound in a context. Sometimes we're wrong about the source or the meaning of the sound, but we never hear sound and don't contextualize it in some way. So that's where the meaning is extracted. But it's a combination of the material, whether that's if we're talking about sound, whether it's sound or if we're talking about visual material, literary material, whatever it may be. It's always a combination of material and context.
Yeah.
So maybe that speaks to the question earlier about the object itself, whatever.
I mean, I guess maybe one of the differences between us, or key difference between us, I think you said this once. Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but
doing that all night.
Yeah, I know that's the claim when to the realist who says, of course there are sounds, they're right there, and you can describe them well or badly, right? And there are false and true descriptions of sounds and descriptions of sonic events. And if you don't think that, then I think you're nuts, but I just think there clearly is. So the response to that is, but wait a second, or with regard to the Aitken piece, nature is a cultural construction. And I want to say precisely the opposite, that culture is a natural construction, right? That culture is a certain kind of thing that certain kinds of creatures, natural creatures, do, and that we need to read that cultural stuff back into that natural domain rather than the other way around. I don't know if that's an accurate, if that divide means, if that those two ways of phrasing that mean anything to you. Maybe. Okay.
Sorry.
Onto the piece here.
I don't know if I have a great example for. In fact, the example I was gonna use. Something that probably wouldn't normally be called sound art. So it's a film that Dan Grant made in the early 80s called Rock My Religion. And to me, it's maybe an additional example of what I was trying to say about the Bob Dylan piece. Graham, I think, takes a similar position to me in that he thinks of rock music, in this case, Patti Smith, Sonic Youth, The Fall, and numerous other bands that come up in here, Black Flag, that there's meaning again in the sonic material of the music, but also meaning in the historical context of the music, in the social context of the music. And so he makes this argument, this film, probably many of you have seen it, is essentially sort of a filmic essay on rock music as a continuation of sort of American history, specifically American religious history from the Puritans to the Shakers, and then sort of Jerry Lee Lewis as the next link in that chain. So this is a little bit of that film. I'll just play a short bit of it.
Jerry Lee Lewis and a whole host partially turned on its head, but also partially kept in that theological domain.
So it's all flux, it's all vibrations, but the cultural context determines its meaning. Every time I use that word,
I just want to say the cultural context is not distinguished from whatever natural context there is. It's all the same. It's not the same thing, it's just the same. But there are different ways of inflecting this kind of material. And culture is a particular way of inflecting material. Just as reading a book is different from, producing chlorophyll.
So if we accept that, and I'm willing to, then how do we make decisions? How do we know what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong? How do we know what to do with the power we have or don't have?
Right, that's the political question again, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I really come up against a problem, because I don't have a problem with the basic description, whether it's metaphorical, and I'm never sure, or literal, about everything is merely flux. I'm willing to accept that, but if accepted, then I need to know, what do I do with this?
Yeah, well, the one answer, I think the one answer to that question is that there's no given to it. I always go back, for me, it's the sort of Nietzschean context, and Nietzsche says, all the world is will to power and nothing besides, and you yourselves are also will to power and nothing besides, and you can call, will to power is the name for it, we can talk about that term, but it's a name for a whole host of, basically a whole host of things I've been talking about. And the question is, how do you decide whether, a will to power is pernicious or not? There's no evaluation other than, what does this organism want? What does it believe should be the case? And how does it how does it foster that? And there's no solution to the question, yeah, but I want to know what's ultimately good. Because the ultimately good, that's a kind of theological question.
Yeah,
but
what's good for
me, for this community, for this whatever. And those are things that are, they're not arbitrary, that's the wrong word for it, but they're groundless, if that, right?
Yeah, no,
I guess I don't see how the political question that arises here arises any differently than in the context that you're describing. I don't know if others have thoughts about this or care about it.
Yeah. I am very, very convinced by Christoph's approach here. I like this Deleuzean, Delantean approach to looking at nature and culture and considering it to be flux. I think that the way you're talking about sound is fascinating. The way of looking at sound as a phenomenon is fascinating. I have a very fundamental, I guess, methodological question that I'd like to pose.
To both of us?
To both of you. That I think might get more at the root of the, it's kind of a meta question of why is this an issue? Why is this an issue when we talk about sound, when we talk about the sonic arts? And I think that something that we're overlooking is the fact that sound and the sonic arts are so fundamentally different from the visual arts. And how are they different, and what can we learn from that difference? And it seems like, in one sense, it really comes back to this notion that sound is a phenomenon, whereas paint is not necessarily a phenomenon. We perceive painting, we perceive sculptures differently, and to talk about sound and the sonic arts in a visual arts context poses certain methodological problems that I don't think have been addressed, at least not openly in this context.
Well, sorry. One of the premises there, which I think Christoph also sort of hinted at earlier, of a difference between sonic material and visual object-based material, sort of painting, sculpture, I think it's a false distinction, because I think we're all completely comfortable at this point in time with a visual art, which is a misnomer already, I think, that's not about painting and sculpture anymore, that's performance, that's body-based, that's social or relational, and so on and so forth, all the various manifestations of that. So, we could ask the question differently, how is sound different or not different from those kinds of practices? And to my mind, it's not so different from those kinds of practices. It's still, largely temporal, it's largely ephemeral, it's about, perhaps about things that move rather than things that are static. I haven't thought through this list yet, but things like that. And so I'd rather put all those practices on the side of sound and say that in theorizing sound, we're also
by implication, theorizing those things. And those are the practices in the art world that interest me most. Painting, I hope I don't offend anybody too much right now, but painting just, I don't understand the point of it anymore. I don't see why anybody would paint in 2010.
I understand what you're saying. But then I think that another important point is maybe you can approach it from a question of institutions and the way institutions influence our reception of music versus visual versus. Because you can't just say, you know, music sound equates to painting, equates to art, equates to performance, equates to this, and thus they're all the same. Thus, there's really nothing to talk about. And that really doesn't create the friction that you're looking for. So maybe talk about it from the perspective of institutions.
Well, I was just going to say, for me, the difference is a question of scale or level, right? So on the one hand, you know, sound and image are the same insofar as there are various kinds of sensory apprehension, stimulation, whatever. But obviously they're different insofar as they're different versions of that, right? So I want to, maybe the sort of philosophical distinction that's always often drawn is that between differences of kind and differences of degree. And I think the worry that Seth has, which I hope I don't fall into, right, is that the claim is that from Cage on, people like Pierre Schaeffer, Francisco Lopez, Christina Kubisch, and others, those folks want to give sound a special quality. That is, image does not get you access to the real, sound does, right? And that Seth finds worrisome. And I find it worrisome only if we take that in a certain way, that sound is different or special. Now, I do think that sound is different or special in some regards, which is to say, which is why I tried to point out at the beginning, sound doesn't have the same relationship, I think, to representation and signification that language or image does. And so in that case, sound is special. I call it different if you want. I don't want to say like it's ontologically, you know, deeper, richer, better, right? But I think if we take that, if we go there, then if we show that sound has that peculiar quality, then maybe sound can be used as a lever to show that image and text are not what people have taken them to be, right? So let's put it in a broader social context. You can say, all right, you know, we can talk about human beings, right? We can say, well, a human being is whatever, it's a living being, whatever. But it matters whether you say a human being is a living being that is halfway between animals and God and has unique, you know, capacities and whatever. Or if you say, human being is something that can do something different than, you know, hippopotamuses can do or, you know, or fruit flies can do, right? Of course, there are differences there. Differences of degree, differences of, right? And I guess I want to say, My interest in using sound as, my interest in talking about the specialness of sound is not to say that it uniquely gives this, but rather it can provide a lever to show that all the arts do something different than cultural theory has taken them to do. I don't know if that makes sense.
Which is what?
Which is what? Okay, right. Let's not talk about image in terms of representation. Let's talk about image in terms of action.
Let's not talk about image.
That's
where I'm at.
I like images. So do you, Karen. Is that Lawrence? Back?
Yeah. But I mean, we have been talking about image for like the last 30, 40 years outside of notions of representation. I feel like, I mean.
How so?
Deleuze, as you mentioned.
Well, Deleuze, for example, in like the Bacon book, right?
Probably the most like important theoretician.
Well, let me just really quickly. So Deleuze's Bacon book, right?
Yeah.
Writes a book on Francis Bacon. Definitely the weirdest thing about Francis Bacon, and again, I'm using it, but definitely the weirdest thing that's ever been written about Francis Bacon, and I guarantee you that no art historian takes it seriously. I'm well.
Well, I was.
Okay, all right. Well, let me just say, that's fantastic. I hope that's true. But it's just to say, because there's an effort to say, let's not think of this painting in terms of biography, in terms of the violence depicted. Let's talk about it as the violence of a particular kind of sensation, right? Not that the thing represents, but that it presents, that it does. What does the painting do?
not what is the thing, you know, it's like, ah, it's Pope and he's, you know, he's ripped apart. It's, right? And so, again, that book took ages to be translated. People thought it was a completely freakish, weird book. The translator was a friend of mine. He was saying, like, it took a huge amount of work to get any publisher to think that it only was because of a Deleuze craze that you know, people thought it was worthwhile. Anyway, but again, I can't come up with other examples.
In his first book, he talks about overcoming representation. Are you talking about, like, an art historical, a sonic discourse?
Art historical discourses?
Art historical discourse, I mean, Brandon's recent book on Tony Conrad.
Pretty late event after.
Writing Iconoclash.
Sorry, what's that?
Lefort's writing on Iconoclash.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that kind of, let's say, realism is, I think, coming around. And philosophically, realism is much more sort of palatable enterprise these days, but still pretty heterodox. And I wish it weren't, so.
I mean, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like...
If you think that Brandon Joseph's book is... But if Brandon Joseph's book is the going thing in art history...
I'm just saying, it's like a very popular one right now. It's an example of that.
Among Us, maybe.
What about the Rosalind Krauss-Kahn?
Yeah,
if presentation is what we're interested in, not representation, why are we looking at pictures at all? I mean, why don't we deal, I mean, and this is the benefit of dealing with the sonic, is that the sonic always presents. If it represents also, fair, you know, okay, maybe you don't think so, but first and foremost, it presents, because it is there in space and in time, in a way, you know, and it's moving, so that you have to be constantly, you know, it's active, it presents. I don't know another way to say it, really. Does that work for everybody? Can I move on from that attention?
you're saying that sound is active and presents. So why are you so interested in the social context and exploring backstory?
Like I say, non-coherent doesn't mean no sound. I'm not looking to get rid of the material. I'm looking to find in the material or to use the material in a way to create friction in context. Okay. But I don't see any way that material can do anything out of context. That's the part that of Christoph's sort of vision that I can never go that last step. I don't know what any material, what any flux, any flow, any energy in and of itself can do, can mean. It just makes no sense to me.
Some of this conversation.
position is represented in that argument, because Fernie Ho too is a formalist, an arch formalist. So
I'm not saying that you represent Fernie Ho.
But that this kind of discussion goes on in that musicological
that
but I don't think it does.
There's a question around I mean, for me, I must say, I find this, the distillation of your disagreement down to the question of the real to be a bit strange, but I'm trying to go with it. But the...
Can you give us an alternate diagnosis?
But I'm saying, like, in that spectral music conversation, there's also an appeal from both sides to an idea of the real that is both formal and, let's say, phenomenological. Oh.
Settle on what he calls a sonic object that's not the, oh, this is maybe too long of an argument, let me just say something about it, and then we can. Something that's not the instrument played, something that's not the hearing of it, but that sonic thing that happens in between, let's say, the generation of a sound and its apprehension. And I think that's really interesting. I think that's fascinating. I think there is such a thing. I think that sounds are real. That is, they're not just products of our hearing, and they're not just properties of sources. That there's something called a sound that has an independent existence. But that's an interesting, that's an interesting source in all of this, because it goes to the question of whether there is some substance, something, really existing thing that's apart from its frame, or whether there's only the frame that produces the thing. I want to say, surely there's both of those things, okay. Right? But the frame doesn't produce the work. The work, I don't know, the Kantian, Derridian, Shaverian stuff are getting too quickly mixed up here. But I just want to say, but that notion that there is that space, that there is a kind of sonic entity that is not just a property product of human hearing is hugely important, and I think is. So back to the political question. So one of the things, the philosophers I admire, this is maybe the last thing I'll say, but the philosophers I admire and the audio artists I admire, many of them I should say, are interested in going back to a kind of, let's say, a physics or a metaphysics of sound in order to get differently at that question, maybe slightly differently, at that question of the political or the social or the whatever, right? In other words, you construct a politics differently if you think of human beings, for example, as creatures like any other creatures, than if you think of creatures, human beings, as special sorts of creatures in the world, right? You construct an ethics differently, you construct a politics differently, and I think too, with the reason for going back to like the Cage, the Schaefer, and the reason why I think interestingly in mid-century, in the mid-20th century, those figures started to do what they did and started to become important, and why they're important to me, is that they try to say like, okay, let's try to articulate sound differently, let's start over in a certain way in order to then get somewhere differently, to sort of articulate a different kind of, you know, so it's not, Schaefer isn't the Schaefer or Cage or whatever, isn't the end of the conversation, it's just the beginning, it's that which tries to remake that, the sonic world differently, or call our attention to it differently.
I think we should.
One more question, and then maybe we'll wrap it up. So.
Okay. Well, I just hello, and I want yes.
Hi,
Betsy. Hi. I just had, and maybe this is probably really appropriate for the end, but I think you've both made a lot of persuasive points, and yet I find myself thinking, you know, surely you can't dispute that everyone hear sounds through some kind of referentiality that in most cases is very personal. And at the same time, surely we can just enjoy the stream of sound moving through ourselves. And I feel a little bit like I wonder if we could view these points of view as bifocals almost. You know, we were talking about the idea of flux and, you know, the universe being composed of flux, and it sort of reminds me of the difference between thinking of the world as flux and energy, or thinking of it as matter, and the fact that you don't actually have to choose one of those two points of view, because they're both valid. They're just different ways of looking at the situation, which is maybe bad terminology. And I wonder if it's possible to sort of take, you know, whatever approach of these two arguments is most helpful to the piece at hand, or to the situation at hand, instead of having to kind of have an essentialist dichotomy between two positions. Because I really feel like there can be, instead of an either or, that there can be a both and to a lot of what you're talking about. And that very moving back and forth between those two points of view is perhaps that very energy, that very flux, right, of the discourse, in the same way that the movement is the flux of the sound and the meaning, you know, pun intended, behind the sound.
it sounds like a great place to end because you're declaring the fight a draw.
Yeah, I'll just say it at the risk of declaring it still open, that not maybe at the risk of, with the hopes of, that I think it's possible that you can consider these as, let's say, discourses at a different level or at a different scale, so that one's appropriate to some one sort of scale, right? Mm-hmm. One and another. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's the case. I think there's some kind of philosophical presuppositions that that I think are rather different. But what I do agree with you is that I think, at least for me, and I said this about my work at the beginning, and I'll certainly say it, that whatever this difference is, it's usually productive for me. That is, it generates something. So if it's a set of differential, you know, forces that's productive, then I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't do what I was doing if there weren't something against which or with which to kind of resonate, fight, whatever. So anyway, that's my last.
Yeah. Well, I agree with that. So I want to make sure that.
Thanks for coming and sitting through.